We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your host, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 327. Not exactly how we wanted the road trip to end. No wins in Arizona, just two quick losses, and then they got out of there. But like you said, they got out of there healthy. That's all you wanted. So I guess all in all, looking back on the road trip, not the worst thing in the world.
I mean, we talked about it before on the last show when we were going into Arizona, and both of us were like, it's going to be, we'd like some wins. That'd be nice. It's going to be, they're a pretty good team. But if we don't come out with wins, not going to be the worst thing in the world. As long as we come out healthy with healthy pitchers, nobody getting hurt, don't do anything stupid, go home, and let's just figure it out when we get back to the Bronx. You know, like, that's just it. And that's where I still am after the losing two.
The fact that Monday was an off day, it just felt like that is when the road trip should have ended, and it didn't. And I think that's how the Yankees played on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yeah, it was kind of weird having that two-game little, like I said, it was like a connection. It was like a connecting flight going home to New York, and you have a long layover in freaking Arizona. You know, like, what was the point of that? I mean, I get, you know, it's the home and home. I get it, but, you know, this isn't college football. Like, can we do some normal scheduling, please?
Right. The two off days in 1 week makes it, this is just a point. This is a weird little tidbit about the MLB schedule where with the interleague play, and then they have to line it up. So you play two against the Diamondbacks this week. And then sometime later in the season, they're going to play two at Yankee Stadium. And because of that, you got a Monday and a Thursday off day. Meanwhile, the Yankees are going to go home and they don't have an off day for like 13 straight days. So,
right.
So it's like, can you meet somewhere in the middle here?
Well, hopefully in the beginning of that stretch, and the fact that we don't have days off, we're getting some bodies back, some reinforcements, so it won't hurt as badly, you know, having like that many in a row. In fact, it might be good with new guys coming back, not having time off, just getting fully into it and getting it back into the groove and immersing themselves completely into baseball. So, you know, guys on the horizon, man, like that's it, right? We need our health back. We need our team back. I feel like we've outlasted this injury thing, and we need it to be over. It's not going to stay. This is not sustainable.
Not sustainable. We kind of talked about it on the last episode, just saying we could see how this is going to end. Like, guys are going to need to have to start coming back soon, or else the house of cards is going to come down, and it's going to come down in a fury.
I don't want to see any more, you know, games where Tyler Wade is getting like five or six Ephus pitches by Zach Greinke, and just like every single pitcher who's throwing a ball to Tyler Wade is throwing under 80 miles an hour.
Taking a lot of shots at Tyler Wade.
And he's just, and I'm a Tyler Dean Wade guy, not in this role though. I don't want to see him every day. I want to see him in the capacity that I had lined him up for, as a role player, a defensive guy that can come in and be a good team guy, not a guy who's playing every single day. That's not where we want him.
You want Wheels Wade to be showing off the speed on the base paths.
I want to make his strengths stand out and help the team and not have to deal with the really bad stuff about his game on an everyday basis, because he's not an everyday player. He's just not. And he's not a utility guy too, in the sense that,
right. So then what is he?
In the sense that you want him to be a utility guy. Let me finish the rest of it, because he's a utility guy in like the old school way, where like a Hechavarria type way, where he's
so
going,
he doesn't bat.
No, he plays defense. He runs the bases.
Right,
he's going to do
bat.
All these things. He's going
to
bunt.
Go up to bat.
He can bunt. He can do the things that you want
for,
him to do.
For
that
all
have nothing,
the times.
That, anything in the infield, he's good with. Just don't expect anything to go in the outfield.
For the two times a year the Yankees bunt, Tyler Wade will be there.
Yes. And that number will go up if Tyler Wade's available to bunt. But not when he's starting every game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, all right. That's enough Tyler Wade talk. Maybe we'll talk about him a little more when we talk about the Greinke. Actually, definitely talk about him more when we talk about the Wednesday afternoon game. Just a couple housekeeping items, though. We got a great show for you today. Later on the episode, Scott, you spoke with Mike Petriello. He does StatCast for MLB.com. He has the StatCast podcast. He writes a bunch of articles for MLB.com. He is a baseball nerd through and through. You talk to him about what?
about numbers, about the analytics of a lot of the stuff that we touched on. Was how did the Yankees get to this point with their replacements? Like, how are these guys doing what they're doing? What were the Yankees looking at to, you know, go out and acquire some of these guys that really were not, you know, hot button guys that people wanted to go and acquire? Cashman and his team made, you know, the phone calls to put themselves in positions to you know, acquire guys at the right time, or to identify players that were, you know, not really that much sought after. And I thought one of the really interesting things that I took away from this, and you know, I kind of knew this in the back of my head, but really haven't really thought about it. But we talk about the analytics and how available those numbers are in the minor leagues. And It's interesting what he was talking about, because, you know, the Yankees, while we know they have an edge with the Department of Analytics and the team of nerds that they have, well, they also have a lot of technology and things that are available to them that maybe other teams don't, or maybe they haven't invested in. And that's a big leg up.
That's the thing, the investment. I've read some articles and I've heard people talk that there's a lot of teams that are not willing to make that investment. Maybe they're willing to do it at the AAA level, maybe even the AA level, but a lot of the low-level single A, the extended spring training games that are going on, all of these different organizations that the team has underneath the main level, they're not willing to make that investment. The Yankees, obviously, they are willing to make the investment. And I think that's also why, and I already know I'm going to get backlash for this. I'm going to get people calling me a shill for the team. But when someone says, oh, the Yankees are cheap, they don't take that kind of stuff into consideration. If they went out and signed Bryce Harper or Manny Machado, I wouldn't have given a crap, because it is not my money. But at the same time, I also understand that they are making investments in other areas teams are not willing to, and it's not just the MLB payroll.
Right. But yeah, like you said, the fan does not care about that. The fan doesn't see those things. They don't care about those things. They don't really, a lot of fans, I think more on the casual side, don't care how their players get to where to get to the point where they're wearing pinstripes. They just want to wear the pinstripes. They don't care about all the other stuff.
But if you don't care about, if you don't make the road good, yeah,
but
for the players.
But they don't understand. They don't care about that justification either. that's the thing. Like, they just want the guys that they want in pinstripes, and that's it.
There are teams literally feeding their single A ball players McDonald's. They will after the game stop the team bus at McDonald's, and guys will wolf down three Big Macs because They're hungry, and they're 20-year-old kids who are professional athletes and they need calories. Whereas the Yankees have like personal, they train them on how to cook, how to eat healthy.
I don't know how far they do that down the line, though.
Oh, they do. I was just reading it in Inside the Yankee Empire. Okay. They're training these guys, especially the guys that are coming in from overseas who have never eaten a healthy meal in their life because they grew up in an impoverished country. They're teaching these guys what nutrition is and how they should be eating healthy meals.
Hey, good for them.
Anyway, how did we get on that?
I don't remember.
What else?
I don't know.
What else do we have to tell people about?
I feel like this is like a really weird time right now, because we've been on the West Coast for a week plus.
My brain
hurts. With these really, really long games, long nights, which I've been up for almost every single one of them. I don't think I missed one game, which is utterly ridiculous. Unless it was during the day and I wanted to do something. That's the problem. There's my problem. Like, if it's at night and I'm just sitting here, I'm like, I'm going to watch it. I'm going to stay awake. But then when it's on during the day, I'm like, I don't want to sit in the house during the day. Like, I want to go do something. So I'll watch the ones till 3 in the morning. But yeah, then the 4 o'clock ones, I'll try to, you know, watch on my phone.
That's good for you.
I have no guilt for those for some reason.
I remember what we wanted to tell people about, and that is George's Box Episode 7 came out Wednesday on their feed, George's Box. If you guys have not subscribed yet, go search for it in wherever you get your podcasts. Episode 7, they talked about a lot of stuff going on with the Yankees, but they also touched on a few Major League Baseball topics. Vladdy Jr., Keith told a hilarious story about
Pablo Sandoval.
Pablo Sandoval, just, I don't want to ruin it, but just being a fatso in the MLB fan cave. So definitely go check that out. We are now in May. It's officially May. You know what that means?
I don't know what that means.
That means May 31st is right around the corner.
Oh, yeah, it does. Oh, yeah, we're still in housekeeping. See, like, my mind is not here. I don't even know. There's a game coming up at like 10 o'clock, right? I got to prepare myself. But no, there's no game. May 31st. Yeah, we're right around like 200 tickets sold already. So we're cruising to the point where I'm you know, this is going to be sold out. We sold over 300 last year. We're right at a month away right now. And, you know, less than half of the tickets are still there. And usually the way that these things work is there's always a late push. And with this Red Sox series, I expect that late push to be earlier. So, and I know of a couple of very, very big groups that are coming in and are just waiting on some people to come in. So, and these are people that have come to games in many times. So get your groups, get your people together, get the May 31st event. Also, right after that, it's going to be faster than we know, but June 22nd, thank you, is a Saturday. This is our only night game on a Saturday because the Yankees schedule at home was weird this year. But it's a 7 o'clock game against Houston. It's going to be a really good game. We still have a bunch of tickets available for that one. That's going to be a really fun event. We're still trying to lock down a parking lot. And we have some good leads on getting a tailgate and working out some things in the back end. So I'm really hoping that comes to fruition, because if it does, that's something that we want to build upon. If not, we'll be at the dugout, but we're working on something good in the background for that one. So get those tickets as well. And also, last thing, the BP Crew chapters, we're doing our first invasion in Tampa. That is going to be on July 6th, which is a Saturday game. And it's the Saturday that we go to Tampa to play the Devil Rays, and we have 200 tickets available. Boom.
That could be for first place.
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be our first like setup invasion. I already have a lot of people that are ready to go. The Tampa chapter is excited for it. This is going to be a lot of fun. I'm not excited to go to the Trop, but I'm excited to yell and scream at the Trop.
You're not excited to see how shitty it is?
Like, part of me a little bit, maybe, for that reason, just shit on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's fun.
that does sound fun. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got
There's nothing that's like appealing to going to that place besides shitting on it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Enough for me. That's enough to warm my cold, dead heart. All right. Let's talk about this road trip. 6-3. I said last episode I was just hoping for 4-5 or 5-4, so 6-3, beautiful. You know, could have asked for a win in Arizona, fine. If you wanted to trade a win, isn't it so funny how the brain works that if they went just maybe split in Anaheim and then split in Arizona, it just feels differently coming home than having lost the last two. But like we said, it was such a quick series, such a quick stop in Arizona. They went up against Greinke, who was filthy on Tuesday night. Just totally shut down their lineup. And that's what Greinke is supposed to do. Greinke, he's on the older side. He's 35 years old. He's not the same pitcher he was when he was in Los Angeles, but he can still shut down a team that is trotting out there a lot of replacement level players.
I mean, that's not even giving him enough credit, though. Just he can shut down a good lineup, too.
He has shut down lineups, because if you look at his... Basically, he got shelled on opening day, and since then he's made six starts and has a 2.01 ERA and a 190 batting average against.
Yeah.
Very, very good numbers.
In today's day, with guys hitting the fastball a mile, and you know, you're seeing more and more breaking balls, when you have a guy who can change locations, change up the speeds, mix everything up, and have like a good mix against a lineup, you're going to have more success. And that's what he does. I mean, he can hit his spots and he can change it up, and he throws a 68 mile an hour, as you called it before we were recording. You and I were talking about the fact, is it an ephus or is it a curve? Well, they categorize it as a slow curve. Mm-hmm. And a slow curve to me is a freaking ephus pitch. It's a spinner. It doesn't curve. It just goes. It floats. It goes from point A to point B slowly. So yeah, like the guy mixes it up. He's got a horrible mullet.
I think it's bleached, it's got like bleached
streaks in the mullet.
He looks like a crackhead from Alabama.
He really does.
Do you know the comedian Theo Vaughn?
Is he the guy that was in like Road Rules?
No. I don't think so.
I think he is.
Google him right now. But he kind of like Zach Greinke looks like Theo Vaughn's kind of drugged out cousin. Anyway.
I think if I Google anything, my screen will screw up.
Don't try it then.
I'm pretty sure it's the guy, though. Actually, I have my phone.
But yeah, whether it's an Ephus pitch, whether it's a slow curveball, he was making some of the Yankees hitters look silly. He throws it about 5% of the time, so he just mixes it in just enough to take you off a fastball that is no longer 95 miles an hour. He's throwing his fastball 89 to 91 miles an hour, so then he pulls back. He's got that slow curve in the arsenal. And as a hitter, it's extremely difficult to adjust to all those different things. He's still going to hit his spots. He's still going to move the ball from side to side on the plate. And when he's changing speeds like that, he's a tough pitcher.
Yeah, yeah, he's just one of those guys that I said this last show that he, you know, he's a guy that can age well because of that, because he can locate his pitches and change up and throw, you know, pretty much everything for a strike. You know, he's dangerous, and he will be until he retires. He will be a pain in the ass and be a good pitcher because he's a good pitcher. He's not just a thrower. The guy can pitch.
And that's the thing that the Yankees had not faced to this point in the road trip, really, since their winning streak started, was tough opponents. Because on the season they...
Well, you're talking about pitching. We did face Madison Bumgarner. I mean...
Yes. Okay. Sorry. Not necessarily just pitcher matchup, but team-wise.
Team matchup. The Arizona Diamondbacks are far and away better than the Giants and the Angels, for sure.
And the Royals, which and is the Yankees beat 3 out of 4 before they went on the road trip. And surprisingly, to this point in the season, we're a month through the season, the Yankees have only played 5 games against teams who are currently above 500. That's very surprising, especially because they played 2 against the Red Sox. No one expected the Red Sox to be below 500 at this point in the season. But they're 0-5 against those teams. 3 against the Astros, these two games against the Diamondbacks. It's such a small sample that you can't really take anything away from it. Right. And also, at least in these 2 games against the Diamondbacks, it is the replacements that are losing these games. It's not,
and
like
these were tight games too. It's not like they were bad games. They were actually good games to watch. They were entertaining games. Good, some good baseball. It was you know, low scoring. I thought the end of both games, like, there was an opportunity to do something.
Especially today, especially games. Wednesday afternoon, the Yankees had a bunch of chances late in that game. At different points in that game, really, with base runners on in innings, a couple calls didn't go their way. And then really the backbreaking moment of the game was Gleyber grounding into the double play in the eighth inning with nobody out. Right. You get first and second. Sanchez has a good at-bat, gets a base hit, and Glaber's up there first pitch, dagger just to the rally. And I know they ended up scoring another run, but that was really, once that happened, I kind of knew the game was not, they're not going to win the game.
Well, I mean, even you go into when Maben had that really good at-bat, too. He was down 0-2 and then worked the count full and then took a walk.
That was the seventh inning.
That was the seventh inning.
And then also you can – so Boone pinch hits Estrada in that next – he pinches it, hits Estrada for the pitcher at that point, and it's a 3-1 count and Estrada swinging. Like, know your role, Tario. Like, take a pitch.
Tario?
Tyro?
Tyro? Tyro? It's not a full th, but it's a Tyro. I don't mind him swinging a 3-1 pitch. I mean, like, someone's gonna do something in this lineup. Might as well be you. If you get a pitch that you like at 3-1, swing the bat. I mean, you're still a professional hitter. And by the way, Theo Von road rules, for sure. That's where he started.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's all I know him from when you said the name. I didn't even know he was a comedian. But
he's a good comedian.
Yeah, look, there were good games. They had opportunities to win. They didn't win. Nobody got hurt. That's all. I'll go back to that. I'm
so
happy.
You just want to skip over it? These games didn't happen.
Yeah, I'm just happy. No, I'm just. I want to make sure that my feelings are out there. I'm happy about it. This is the happiest I've ever been after a sweep.
Would you have rather they won the 2 games but lost another player?
No. Who's the player? Who's the player?
That's a good question.
No, yeah. I don't want
to
lose anybody.
If it's like Gary Sanchez again or Luke
Voigt,
then
I don't
want to
lose anybody. I'm joking. I don't want to lose anybody. They're all important people at this point. Everybody's important.
Well, maybe not Tyler Wade.
All of them are important.
CeCe's important. He got his 3,000th strikeout. That was early in the game on Tuesday. Everyone was sort of just waiting for that moment to happen. He was only 3 strikeouts away. He got it on old friend John Ryan. Don't call him J.R. Murphy. Couple of interesting stats on the 3,000 strikeouts over CeCe's career. So number 1,000, Ichiro, Hall of Fame name. Number 2,000, Torii Hunter. Not a Hall of Famer, but brand name. If you've watched baseball over the last 2 decades, you know the name Torii Hunter. Number 3,000, John Ryan Murphy. Doesn't really fit in that trio, but nevertheless, there he is.
But also very cool because John Ryan Murphy, being a former New York Yankee, caught CeCe Sabathia. They're friends. He was talking about him, how they text and talk. And also John Ryan Murphy caught CeCe Sabathia's 2,500th strikeout. So there's history there with him as well with Miles. So it's kind of cool how that puts a nice little bow on it. It was funny because when you hear CeCe talk about it, he obviously did like 1,000 interviews afterwards. He was probably so ready to get through those interviews. And talking about Giant Ryan Murphy, but, you know, they talked and they were friends. And that was the one, there were two guys he didn't want it to be. He didn't want it to be Greinke because he's a pitcher. And they didn't want, he didn't want it to be Giant Ryan Murphy because he was a friend. So those were the two guys he didn't want it to be.
Well, then he should have walked him.
Yeah, well, he struck him out. He said I'll sign some things for him. Kind of gave a little chuckle
it's
after
kind
that.
Of an insult.
Yeah, he knew it too. He knew what he said. It. He was kind of like giving a shot.
It's still best John Ryan Murphy moment is when he's getting champagne dumped. Or actually, he's dumping champagne on.
He's hammered.
The 2015 wild card celebration.
Yeah. 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 No. Yeah. He looked like a college kid ready to go. They all did. It was great.
I tweeted out this poll. Would you rather, as a player, put yourself in a player's shoes, have 3,000 hits or 3,000 strikeouts? I thought this was going to be a landslide, but I also tweeted out the information that 32 players have 3,000 hits and only 17 players have 3,000 strikeouts. So the 3K strikeout club is more exclusive than the 3K hit club.
The poll go ahead.
The poll results, 53% to 47% people want the hits. But I thought it was going to be 75-25, honestly.
Yeah. Oh, maybe because, you know, of what's happening now.
But.
Yeah. But also, CeCe was, you know, the third lefty to do it, too, which is extremely exclusive. Now you're talking about Randy Johnson, Steve Carlton, and CeCe Sabathia. And, you know, he was talking about it as well, and that he's not, you know, he's thinking about the fact that he's a black pitcher and that he's the one guy representing black baseball players in that club and how important that is to him. And he's talked about that before, but I think it's just an interesting dynamic of what's happening, especially in today's game, just because it's such a narrative at certain points. But you know, I would rather be a pitcher personally, but
interesting. Why?
Yeah. Because I don't know. I think when you're going up against when you're a pitcher and you're going up against all these major league caliber guys, and you get to 3,000, that means your longevity as a pitcher. To me, longevity as a pitcher almost is more impressive when you get to that point than it is as a hitter.
Like the fact that
stayed on your body for
I
that
think
long
over the last two decades that's
and was functional.
The case.
Yeah, yeah. It's just it's very rare. So if you did that, one, you had a very long career. And two, you were effective your entire career.
I did not. If you had asked me before I looked up the stat, I would have assumed there were more strikeout guys with 3,000 strikeouts than 3,000 hits.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You said that you'd rather be a pitcher. I think I'd rather be a position player who hits, but I think that if given the ability, I think I would be a better pitcher than I would position player. The reason being is because I think that for pitcher you can outthink, it's a thinking
you think you're
game.
Smart. You think you're smarter than everybody else is what you're saying.
I think so. That's what I'm saying. No. I think that if you're willing to do the work and the preparation, that you can outthink the batter. You are in a position of dominance when you have the ball on the mound instead of a position of reaction where you are in the batter's box. Right. I was also I sound like one of those douchey callers up to WFAN. I was a catcher in high school. Part of the fun of catching was working with the pitcher, calling the game, even though most of the guys only had two pitches at that point anyway, but it's still the strategy involved was fun for me.
On the other side of that, isn't it then, to your logic, more impressive of the batter getting that many hits, considering he
I'm
was
talking
not
about
in
what's
a position
more impressive.
Of dominance?
I'm not saying what's more impressive.
Yeah, just where you want to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's more sexy to get 3,000 hits.
It depends how you're getting them. If you're just getting a bunch of singles, if you're just a guy who's getting on base, I think the strikeouts, very sexy.
Tell me more. So for you guys listening at home, we're doing video. We're starting to do more video, so it just the look on his face when he said that just threw me for a loop. Let's talk about the replay nightmares on Wednesday afternoon. Boone gets tossed late in the game, really because of a play that happened earlier in the day where Tyler Wade hits a ground ball, trying to turn two. Mike Tauchman's going to second base. It looks like the shortstop comes off the bag too early. They call Tauchman out at second base. Boone challenges it. It's not overturned. even though replay, I think, clearly shows the guy is off the bag too early. The old, quote, neighborhood play. If this were 2010, it wouldn't even be a question. No, nobody cares. Neighborhood play, done. Like, we know. It's okay. It's a neighborhood play. But now, everything's by the centimeter. We gotta do the replay. And then they just didn't overturn it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they if you ask them, I haven't even heard their reasoning, but if they were to comment on it, I bet they would say there was not enough evidence to turn it over. That's not clear and, you know, decisive evidence.
That's what they say for everything. Every time there's not an overturn, that's what
it doesn't matter, like, what happens. Yeah, but even if there is an overturn, like the home run ball that Glaber hit, a clear evidence. You had clear evidence to call that an out? No, you did not. So they go on the other side of it. And
that's the reason that people get so mad about replays.
Yeah, because it goes both ways. It's so inconsistent.
Not consistent. Yeah.
There's nothing consistent about it.
I think everyone is on the same page that if you're going to have instant replay, at least be consistent with the way you call things.
Because by getting it right?
But obviously by getting it right. But otherwise, we're just wasting our time.
It took over 2 minutes for them to stay with the call on the field that was clearly wrong. And so why is that good? Because the whole point of it is not to decisive evidence and all this other bullshit. The point of it is to get the calls right. That's the reason it's there. And if they would just lean on that and say, look, we're here to get the calls right. This is not a court of law where you have to prove a guy, beyond a shadow of a doubt. You have to just get the call right. That's it. You don't have to prove it to anybody. Just get it right. He was off the bag.
He was off the bag, but I'm not even mad.
And then they're also talking about, like, the ball doesn't. Jeff Nelson was talking about how the ball. They're saying the ball just has to enter the cavity of the glove, not hit the back of the leather. Like, what are we talking about here, man? Like, we're talking about when the ball disappears. Is that it? Like, at what angle? Because what if the angle that where you can see the ball all the way through is the one angle where you can see where the foot's off the bag? Then how do you know?
That's like when George Costanza ate the eclair out of the trash can, and he said it wasn't.
There was nothing wrong with that. It wasn't on top.
It wasn't below. It wasn't below the rim. It wasn't below the cavity. It was sitting on top, clear, visible.
Yeah.
But I'm not even mad that the call necessarily. I'm not mad about the call because I think it should have been a double play. It should have been an out at second base.
Right. I agree.
He was feet off the, like, Talkman was feet from the bag. It wasn't a bang bang play. The guy just brought his foot off the bag too early. It's a neighborhood play that doesn't get called before this instant replay bullshit. So I'm not even mad about necessarily the fact that the Yankees, that it was an out. I'm more mad about the hypocrisy of replay because a week earlier we see the hidden ball trick, whatever it is, with Tyler Wade, where, like you said, he's lifting up his leg literally to pass some gas and he gets called out because he's off the bag by a centimeter for a split second. It's like, if we're going to go down to the microscopic centimeter like that, then you have to always do it. You can't be inconsistent.
Yeah, it's dumb. It was just the neighborhood play. Here's the other thing. The whole point, the reason why Major League Baseball has implemented some of these new rules, right? The whole no collisions at home plate, at second base, you know, the runner has to go directly into the bag. They're not allowed to slide around the bag like they used to and put their hand out and break up a double play. Like, all that stuff is now being, you know, penalized. But yet the neighborhood play is off, and the neighborhood play really is a player safety thing. I mean, that's what it is at the end of the day. It's so bang bang that they're not going to be in a degree. They want the player to sweep the bag, come across, and make a clear throw. You know, if they're right around the bag, then it's an out because clearly they were there in time, and they don't want those collisions to happen at second base. So if we're taking away that neighborhood play and we're going to be down to the nicky, that's when you start getting guys standing on the bag with a straight leg and people coming into it and knocking out knees and taking out bodies and things like that. So it's pretty counterintuitive to the way that the rule is supposed to be, you know, on the side of player safety. I don't understand that part of it. So there's a lot of contradictory things when it comes to replay and the player safety and what they're trying to do with the game. And that just happens when you tinker this much with a product that was just fine in the beginning.
You also take fun out of the equation, I think, because
it's what people were talking about for three innings. And that's not what you should be talking about for three innings. You should be talking about the action on the field, not if the dude's foot was off the bag by a centimeter or not. And every time there's a replay that doesn't go one way or the other for a certain team, I think it takes fun out of it for a fan. It takes fun out of it for people watching the game. And at the end of the day, this is entertainment. Baseball is supposed to be fun, and it's just not fun when we have to deal with that crap.
Well, and it also breaks the momentum of the game. I mean, the game has a flow. And when you're sitting there for 2 minutes for no change, for literally no reason at all, we're just standing around watching guys do nothing. I mean, the people on the field aren't even making any decisions. There's some guy in an office wearing a suit. And now we have to, you know, the game is now, and everybody in the stands and everybody watching is now at the mercy of this, you know, this guy behind a bunch of screens and still can't get it right. Like, they got to fix it. You know,
we say that.
Got to fix it.
How many times has one of us said they got to fix it, and well, it's not getting fixed?
There's nothing else to say about it. They got to fix it. Do a better job, people. Do a better job.
Do your job.
Just get the calls right, man. Like, that's all I ask. Get the calls right.
Yeah, and it did hurt the Yankees. If it went their way, they would have had two runners on and said they lost a base runner and they were struggling for runs. So yeah, it certainly could have come back to bite him. And I think Boone was pissed. That's obviously why I think he got thrown out of the game late on a ball that Tyler Wade is in the middle of all this stuff. Tyler Wade is attempting a bunt. The ball's in the dirt. It does not hit his left foot. They showed the side angle. It clearly hops over his left foot. And if you had any doubt about it, he does not move his foot an inch when it goes over him, meaning it did not hit him. Because if you get hit in the foot with a major league pitch, it's going to hurt, and he did not flinch.
So here's the problem with replay, again, in a game that happens very fast. You're taught, especially in a position like that, to get on base, right? You got to get on base. It doesn't matter how you get on base, just get on base. It's a close game. We need base runners. I don't care how you do it, get on base. And when you're playing the game and that ball is as close to it, and I'm sure he felt something, like he felt the dirt, he felt something, he knew it was close. He's like, I'm going to sell this and go down to first. I'm going to get on base.
He didn't
sell. Fine. But here's the deal. You don't think about it in the middle of that there's freaking cameras everywhere and there's replay. Your mind's not processing that, and you're just trying to sell something that's not there. And yeah. And when you're so clearly wrong, you know, then it becomes, you look like an idiot. But what are you taught? You're taught to get on base. Taught to, you know, lean into a pitch. How many times have people said, lean into a pitch, get on base? I don't care. Lean into a pitch.
No, I'm not blaming Tyler Wade for saying it hit me trying to get on base. But
No, I know that. But it's one of those things where the game is slowing down in an unnatural way in a lot of cases. And it's against the way the game should be played.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and
it's a fast game.
But
when you slow it down, then it's like you're adding an element that, you know, maybe I just sound like an old man now, but you're adding an element that's changing the way that the game has been played for years and years and years and years, and it's been fine.
But this change has been happening for a while now. They're intentionally changing some of these things.
I know that, but I don't know what the benefit, in the grand scheme of things, unless you're getting calls correct, and they did in this instance, unless you're getting the calls correct, I don't understand the point of it.
And I think there's certainly, you can cherry pick different plays over the course of history that said if there was instant replay.
Jeffrey Mayer is the first one that everybody thinks of.
Jeffrey Mayer, I don't even know the players involved, but I know it was the Royals and the Cardinals, and it was a World Series. And there was it was a key play, and there was a guy clearly out at first, and he was called safe, or maybe it was vice versa. This was in the 80s. It's I was not alive at the time. You were like 15 at the time. So, but like it's certain plays you can pick throughout history and say, okay, yes, replay would have clearly changed this outcome. But for every one of those, there's 50 of these like we're talking about today, and I just don't know if it's worth it. You quickly mentioned Jeff Nelson. What did you think of him on the calls and the broadcast?
So I was listening to the first game, and I had not caught the news that it was Jeff Nelson in the booth, and I had no idea
who
was
this guy.
I was like, who was talking to Kenny Singleton? Are they doing like that? Because remember last year at one point, I think it was like a Saturday game though, they brought on they did a broadcaster mix up, a mashup, and they had someone else from the other side.
Oh, like they flip booths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was that actually. I was trying to think about who it was before I asked or before I looked, and you know, Jeff Nelson comes up. I thought he was fine. It's when you hear the same guys over and over again for such a long time, you're just, you know, you're in a routine. And then when you hear somebody new, you're like, wait a minute, what's up? What's different here? And who is this guy? What is he doing in the box?
Well, the West Coast games always get the random announcers because some guys don't want to go out to the West Coast.
Yeah. But Kay went out for the Angels series. He must have just wanted a vacation and be in LA anyway.
Wasn't he at the San Fran series too?
Was it? He was working the booth with Flaherty,
and then he was working the booth with Kenny in San Fran, and then Kenny went down to Arizona, and then because usually Flaherty gets those games.
Flaherty doesn't usually work with Kay. Flaherty is usually with Rucco.
He gets the games on the West Coast. Yeah. Rucco sometimes. Yeah.
But I thought Jeff Nelson was good. I thought he added some different commentary. I love Kenny Singleton. So the fact that these guys are just having like a baseball conversation during the game, I enjoy the banter. I think it's good. I thought there were some good stories that came out of it, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, no complaints. Quick injury update. So Gio Urshela, we saw him play. That's really good news. He was day to day, but he pinch hit on Tuesday, played on Wednesday. LeMahieu was day to day. I think it was interesting that he did not pinch hit in the ninth inning on Wednesday.
I think that's pretty telling.
What does that? Exactly. What does that tell you? Romine pinch hit instead. I think if they had more confidence that LeMahieu was going to be back, they would have pinch hit him. But I think that they did not, in case they need to put him on the IL, and then they can retroactive it to Sunday.
Well, that and also that there's a day off tomorrow. It's a travel day. So, you know, if you don't play him on in today's game, you're getting a full, you know, almost week of rest at that point, you know, with a couple off days going back home. So you're really taking advantage of the amount of rest. If you have to ramp him back up again for one at bat, like, is it worth it at that point?
Could have been.
It was a big position. It was a big spot.
If he gets a base hit there, who knows?
Yeah, no, it was a big spot. And you know, to his credit, Romine hit the ball hard. Unfortunately, it was just right at the right fielder. So nothing you could do about that. But yeah, I think really they had these extra days, and the fact that tomorrow is also a day off, they just wanted to give him that extra day to get ready. Look, I'm hoping it's that. Yeah. Honestly, like, I'm really hoping it's that, because the Yankees cannot afford to lose LeMahieu at this point. And you know, it's concerning when you see the knee become the problem 2 days after the incident occurred. You know, like, to me, that's concerning, because that means it's still flaring up. There's still issues. There's still something irritated in that knee days afterwards. And he was playing on it, so it was, you know, it was being aggravated as he was playing on it. Even though he was playing well, it was still being aggravated. So you just need rest at that point, hopefully.
And we're looking at guys who are going to be coming back soon. Andujar could be back on this homestand. That's awesome. But what happens if we get Andujar back and then we lose LeMahieu? You know, it's like, okay, you're just trading. You're just,
you know what it is, Andrew? It's trading. Next man up. That's what it is. It's next man up.
But it's just trading. That doesn't help you. You're trading one guy that's going to help you for one guy that was helping you.
Yeah, I mean, you're still trying to get the guys back. I mean, you can't worry about who's going to go down.
Of course not. But it's one of those things that it's just yet another thing with this team. We could see Andujar back. We could see Frazier back. Frazier's putting out stuff on Instagram like he's ready to go. They were hoping that was going to be just a regular 10-day trip to the IL for Frazier anyway, and he's going to be back. Then not far behind them, Tulowitzki and maybe Stanton, I think, would be the next two guys. So if I had
Tulo left the game today, I think.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I think so. I'll look it up.
See that news. But if I had to bet, I would say Andujar comes back and Frazier are the first two that would come back.
It seems like Frazier's going to be ready to go. I mean, he was even talking about it today, or Kenny was talking about it, about him saying that he was out there running, you know, and he feels much better. So I do feel like that was more precautionary, honestly. That's just kind of what it felt like. Maybe there was a little bit more of a, you know, some of the foot was more swollen than they wanted it to be, and they just didn't want to mess around. So I expect him to be back.
And with Miggy, so they talked about the Yankees maybe using him just at DH. I don't think that's a good plan if you're planning on doing that for the rest of the season, but what you could do is just use him at DH until other guys come back.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be flexible with him, I think, and they're not going to put him out there, especially with Urshela doing what he's doing. I don't think Urshela's going anywhere. You know, I got to look. I feel like we have to, like, identify what the roster looks like on every given day to see where the spots are, where the spots are and where they're not, because it's going to become a numbers game at some point. Like, who's got to go, who doesn't, what's going on with the bullpen, how many off days do we have, you know, who's rested, who's pitching, who's not, because it's going to be a shuffle.
Well, there's too many infielders assuming everyone's healthy, but yeah. I think that's way too big of an assumption to make.
Yeah. Well, I think this is where the Tyler Wade thing comes into play, I think, because Tyler Wade, he's been a topic way too much.
Get out of here, Tyler Wade.
But a guy like if I'm looking at what's happening with this team, like a guy like Talkman is, I'm sending him out before I send Tyler Wade out, because Tyler Wade can also play the outfield.
Okay. Yeah, and it's not like Talkman's hitting better.
We're not losing anything. Yeah,
Talkman's
we're not losing more
than Tyler Wade, and
not by a lot.
I guess any added benefit that Wade can give you with speed, I guess, would be worth it at that point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He's more flexible. He does give you the dynamic of other ways, the way he's truly supposed to be intended to be used this year. And Talkman, yeah, ever since Talkman left Yankee Stadium, he's been struggling.
Yeah. I want to bring up a sort of a random thought that I had this week. I was tweeting about Gary Sanchez, how Gary Sanchez and Luke Voit need to be the two big power guys that carry the Yankees offense while they're waiting for players to come back. And just the difference of responses I got on social made me realize that Sanchez is probably the most divisive player on this team. There's either the Romanites, who you guys are familiar with. I dubbed them this winter, and now I'm dubbing the El Krakenites. Those are the Gary Sanchez supporters. You have the Sanchez supporters versus the Romine supporters. And you're nodding your head no. You disagree.
I'm saying I don't know where the Romine supporters, how they live.
How they live that every time Gary Sanchez doesn't hit a home run, makes an iffy play in the field, they are blurting out that Austin Romine needs to be the starting catcher.
Okay, they're stupid.
Okay. There are people out there who believe Austin Romine needs to be starting over Gary Sanchez. Right. And I think it's a problem, because I like Austin Romine as what he is, a quality backup catcher who gives you good at-bats and handles pitchers. He's not a defensive Jabberwocky that people make him out to be.
Right.
Because
they just assume he is because he's a backup catcher, and that's just not the case.
This is not Jose Molina back there.
Right.
So you look at their defensive metrics. I'll break it down. So Gary Sanchez, 5 errors. Let me first say this. Gary Sanchez has caught 121 innings this year. Austin Romine, 104 innings. So both decent sample sizes. Gary Sanchez, 5 errors. Not great. He had a lot of throwing errors early in the season that added to that total. Romine, no errors. Okay, so if you're just looking, if you're a casual fan who doesn't look past errors in fielding, you're going to say Gary Sanchez sucks, Austin Romine's great. But when you look at it more, Gary Sanchez has allowed 7 stolen bases and caught 1 stealing. Not great. Romine's allowed 10 stolen bases in fewer innings and only caught 1 stealing. They both have 2 pass balls. Gary Sanchez has 6 wild pitches, including 1 today with Tanaka on the mound. Austin Romine has 4 wild pitches. So a lot of these stats are similar. And in the case of stolen bases, Romine does not have nearly as good of an arm as Gary Sanchez. And a lot of those stolen bases happened in the first weekend of the season when Sanchez threw 2 balls into center field trying to throw runners out.
I mean, I'm not taking anything away. By the way, Tulowitzki was pulled after he got on base. Tightness in the calf. Bye-bye.
I don't care about Troy Tulowitzki. I said this from the beginning, the moment they signed him. Waste of friggin' time. I don't care.
It doesn't matter. He's not playing. So, I mean, tightness in the calf, that's not good for him anyway.
Chow,
so, he hit a home run, though, too. But the... The catcher situation, Gary Sanchez, the fact, if we're talking about errors that on balls that he threw, like, you're crazy if that's what you're crying about. The fact that, you know, we're talking about errors where he's blocking the ball and balls are getting through him, that's a different thing. The throwing errors, come on. Like, beginning of the season, like, that's his strength. We all know that's his strength. If you don't identify that as a strength of his, you're crazy. And if that's an argument that anybody's leaning on, like I highly question their baseball IQ. I really do. Because when you look at the players, it's so very clear who the better player is, who the starter needs to be. And that's just it.
I mean, I get it. Austin Romine's better at blocking balls in the dirt. I think he's always going to be better at blocking balls in the dirt, but that is the only thing he's better than Gary Sanchez at. And if you want to look at pitcher ERA with each one catching, I know a lot of people make a big deal out of this. I really don't. The whole personal catcher thing, we went over it in length last year with Sonny Gray.
And everybody has talked about Sanchez, how he's a good receiver and they like throwing the ball to him.
I think it's stupid, the personal catcher thing. But if you want to look at these stats,
The team has a 3.95 ERA with Gary Sanchez, and it has a 4.57 ERA with Austin Romine. I know there's a lot of variables that go into that. Who's catching? Who are they playing when that guy is catching? Because if you're going up against the Houston Astros versus going up against the Kansas City Royals, obviously you're going to have different ERAs because one team is a much better hitting team than the other. But over the season so far, in 121 innings versus 104 innings, better ERA with Gary Sanchez.
Oh, and by the way, it's a bad time for them to be talking about Austin Romine being a starting catcher because freaking Gary Sanchez just hit a grand slam to the moon, 70 some feet, some stupid amount. And then, oh, by the way, the next day or day after that, he hit another monster shot. So there's an offense, which is half of the game, that he's, you know, literally the best hitting catcher in baseball. So, you know, I don't even know why this is a thing. I don't know what they just, people need to stop.
If you guys, if you, Scott, or anyone out there wants to test this Krakenites versus Romanites, just tweet out something about Gary Sanchez or tweet out something about Austin Romine and you'll see the vitriol that goes into your mentions because it happens. And it's just crazy because usually the fans side with a player that comes up and is homegrown, right? You almost give those kind of guys more benefit of the doubt in a lot of
cases. They're both homegrown, though.
Yeah, you know what I mean, though. Gary Sanchez is...
They're both homegrown.
Especially what Gary Sanchez did back in the second half of 16.
The problem is that they're both homegrown guys. Austin Romine is more of a blue-collar guy.
More people can identify with Austin Romine.
Gary Sanchez has had bouts with quote, laziness, has had issues in the minor leagues with his effort.
I'm not denying those. I think that is an issue, I think.
No. I think that's why people are more critical of him because of those things.
We killed him for the hustle gate last year.
Because it was on top of a billion other things. It was on top of a billion other things, but... Either way, if the Yankees are going to be a team that's going to produce and going to be playing at a high level and deep into the season, they need Gary Sanchez to be the guy that we think he can be, and that's both, you know, improving. He doesn't need to be, and I've talked about this in the past, like his defense sometimes drives me nuts, but I just need him to be, you know, I need to see improvement. I want to see him, you know, being a better catcher. I don't need him to block every single ball. It's not something that's necessary. When you have the bat that he has and the fact that he has such an impact on the game on the offensive side and throwing the ball and keeping runners at bay, the value is insane. So yes, he's going to miss some balls that are in the dirt. I understand that. It just cannot be at alarming rates.
Thought you would get more of a kick out of Krakenites. I was pleased with myself on that one.
The Krakenites?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I went right to like smoking crack. That's what I was thinking of.
I didn't see where your mind is. All right,
maybe it's because there's another side of it.
You spent too much time in Norfolk, crack. Virginia, my friend.
A lot of crack.
Going home to play the Twins. The Twins are pretty good this year. First place in their division. They're fourth in team home runs. First in team OPS. This is not the normal Twins team we see. But they are usually a Yankees punching bag, so I think it's good. You're coming home after a successful road trip, day off on Thursday, can beat up on the Twins. But it is a start of a 13-game stretch with no off days in there. So three against the Twins, four against Seattle, and then a quick trip down to Tampa for three, and then three more against Baltimore. So not the easiest of stretches for the Yankees coming home.
No, and Minnesota, that's another thing I talked to Mike about. In the next segment is the fact that the Minnesota Twins are having, you know, their best start as a franchise with the power and slugging and the amount of, you know, home runs that are leaving the park. And a lot of that is because they've played the Baltimore Orioles a lot.
But you know why else that is?
Well, Mike was talking about also this, the fact that he's on the same page as us, I believe, in the fact that they're so bad historically, possibly the worst pitching staff that has ever been assembled.
Baltimore?
Yes.
No, I know, but you know why else the Twins are hitting for power?
Nelson Cruz.
Rocco Baldelli is their manager. Pride of Rhode Island.
I thought Nelson Cruz brought some special sauce in.
Probably. That's more likely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But we get to see, I'm so excited for this, Michael Pineda on the mound in the Bronx on Sunday afternoon. Michael Pineda against Domingo Germán. I feel like that's a great pitching matchup. Oh, because
it scares me.
Domingo Germán is like,
the pitcher we wanted Michael Pineda to become. Like, what we're seeing Domingo Germán right now do is like flashes of Michael Pineda when we saw him like go out there and strike out 16 Baltimore Orioles on Mother's Day. But Pineda has allowed 37 hits in 29 innings, so it would not shock me if he pitches a 7-inning, 2-hit shutout against the Yankees.
That's the problem. That's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of we're not going to see the car wash flailing hands because he's not going to show that emotion at home being in a Twins uniform. It's not the same thing. So we're not going to see that. That's what we're used to. But, you know, the Jekyll and Hyde, that was his nickname for us for a long time, Jekyll and Hyde. The guy had all the tools in the world, massive human being. He was the good side of the Jose Montero trade, supposedly. Jesus Montero, whatever the hell. The ice cream-hating machine of Jesus Montero. And just nobody won that trade. That's just the end of the day. Nobody won that. We all
ended
lost.
Up deciding that we all lost. The Yankees lost the trade because we had to suffer more through Pineda than the Mariners had to suffer through Montero.
Yeah. So it was. But yeah, I expect him to come out there and probably light us on fire, and it's going to piss me off.
I think if Pineda is like through three innings and hasn't allowed anything, I think Boone needs to ask the umpires to check him for pine tar.
Yeah.
Just to mess with
this. It doesn't really have to, you don't have to check anybody. It'll be glistening. You'll see it because he's not very smart. He puts it like on his cheek.
All right. That is pretty much it for this episode, except you're going to talk to Mike. And before we get to the Petriello segment, we're going to give away a t-shirt because you mentioned it last week. So if you guys left us a rating and review in iTunes, you may be winning a t-shirt right now. We do really appreciate all the ratings and reviews. As we say over and over again, it helps us out immensely. It is the number one thing other than actually listening to this show that you guys can do to support us, because the simple truth is the more ratings, the more reviews we get, the more people will see this podcast, the more people will listen to it. If a Yankees fan goes into iTunes or searching wherever, they're going to find us if they see a bunch of good reviews. So we appreciate it. Scott.
Yeah, I'm going to get greedy also wins? And say that telling a friend of yours to listen to our show and subscribe is also something that you could do that would be very beneficial to us. So thank you. That would be the other thing as me getting greedy. But winner of the t-shirt is Calabell. That's all I got. Calabell is you give us 5 stars, he or she, and says, I don't know what I would do at my office job if I didn't have these guys to listen to, being one of the few fans in Boise, Idaho. It's great to hear some baseball talk. It doesn't involve the Mariners, Rockies, or some dumb California teams. I love being able to hang out at a bar, talk circles around the guys and girls that think they know more knowledge, have more knowledge about sports and insights, and the recaps and insight from Andrew and Scott help out. You guys making West Coast fan much better, and I can't wait to come to the stadium to one of the events. Awesome. I read most of that accurately. A lot of words I skipped, but so, sentiment being the same.
I have this person says they're West Coast. They're a full Idaho. State from the West Coast. Oregon is in the middle. I mean, you got to go through all of Oregon.
So are you telling me that Idaho is Midwest?
No.
So where are they? They're mountain. They're a mountain region.
They're mountain people.
Yeah, like, I don't know. You There's
say,
corn.
Would you say Ohio is the East Coast?
No, but it's further away than the coast than Idaho.
No.
I don't know. One state. I would say Pennsylvania would probably say East Coast.
Well, Pennsylvania borders the Atlantic Ocean.
Where?
Philadelphia?
No.
No?
There's a Delaware Water
Gap. There's a little
gap.
River that goes up there.
It's called the Delaware Water Gap. The Delaware River. Yeah, no, you're bad at geography. Just stop it. Just stop what you're doing. Pennsylvania would probably claim East Coast, though.
I think Pennsylvania is more East Coast than Idaho is West Coast.
I barely know where Idaho is, if I'm being very honest with you. I know that it's over there somewhere, and there's either potatoes or corn. One of the two. I think now I said corn, but I think it's potatoes, actually.
Iowa's corn.
Fine. They play baseball in Idaho or just Iowa?
I think they play football in Idaho.
All right. Are we going home? Is this West Coast trip done yet? Because I'm
yes,
delirious.
I think what we have found in this podcast, this Wednesday evening podcast, after a bunch of late nights on the West Coast, after a bunch of meetings and all that kind of stuff for both of us, I know. Our brains are fried, and I think that's the product that you got, so I hope you guys enjoyed it. Stay tuned for the segment Scott did with Mike Petriello from the StatCast podcast. You're going to learn a thing or two, I think, from that segment. We will talk to you guys on Sunday. Actually, on Monday. We're going to be speaking on Sunday. The episode will come out on Monday. You guys want to submit...
I think they understood.
You guys want to submit mailbag questions or call the voicemail line, you guys know where to do it. Do that from Monday's show. We'll talk to you then.
Guys, I'm excited to bring on Mr. Mike Petriello, who writes for MLB.com and hosts the StatCast podcast to talk some Yankees baseball and some of this advanced metrics analytics stuff that we've been talking about so much with all our replacement players coming up. Mike, thanks so much for coming on and joining me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So obviously the Yankees are doing something that's, you know, relatively unprecedented in the sense that they're still winning with a lot of these guys that, you know, really wouldn't be in the major leagues right now. And we're trying to get to the bottom of it, figure out why exactly this is all happening. And I wanted to talk with you, obviously, because of your, you know, your advanced knowledge and the advanced metrics. So what if you could identify something when you're looking at these guys and possibly what the Yankees have looked at? You know, we've seen the wins with from Brian Cashman with Didi and Hicks. And now Luke Voit is, you know, come to the top of the mountain as far as the Cashman gems. Is there something that the Yankees have identified that they're looking for in position players, or are these all very individual cases?
Yeah, I don't think it's one specific thing. I mean, they were pretty clear with Luke Voit that they liked, you know, his exit velocity and hard hit stats in the minor leagues, which we don't have access to. I don't even have access to it here. And I don't think that it's probably the same thing he would have said about Didi Gregorius or maybe even Aaron Hicks. You know, I think with Voit, obviously, you know, it's not like they went out and cherry picked him off the hands of an organization who's like super far behind the times. Like the Cardinals are not, you know, an unintelligent organization. I think they just didn't necessarily have room to give him a chance because they had Matt Carpenter playing first base, and then they, you know, made that trade. So I think part of it's about opportunity, but certainly part of it is, you know, you have to have something more than just AAA stat lines to make you interested in a righty-righty first baseman who's in his late 20s. And clearly they saw something there that they really liked. And I imagine, you know, 28 other teams and maybe the Cardinals as well wish they had seen the same thing. I mean, this is the sort of thing that the Yankees and other teams like the Astros, the Dodgers, they always sort of be out in front on. And clearly, Voit in the early weeks of the season has proven it's for real. You know, he's, as I saw him say in an article today in The Athletic, he didn't want to be the next Shane Spencer. And so far, so good on that.
Yeah, no, I was just reading that actually, him talking about how there's been that comparison, because there has, you know, the Shane Spencer having that late surge, you know, at the end of the year, and him, you know, Voit saying, I got to write my own story now. I'm not Shane Spencer. I'm not that guy. I'm trying to write my own story. And he's always talked about how he's got the belief that the guy does not lack in confidence. That's for sure. I mean, he knows he can hit, and he even identifies that he's got some work to do in the field. But he always knew that he could hit. So do you think this was like just a simple change of scenery and, you know, a guy that is, you know, has full belief in his confidence to produce like this on the major league level?
I mean, I think it's probably three or four different things. I think number one is simply opportunity. You know, the Cardinals never really gave him much of an opportunity. He had like, I think, a cup of coffee with St. Louis, and that's about it. Not that he did all that much in that time, so that's fair. But I think it's really more about opportunity. And then, you know, we read probably the same article in The Athletic this morning, and it seems clear that the Yankees gave him a lot easier access to the technology that he's interested in. He doesn't have to go into the video room at the stadium to see what he wants. He gets it served to him on an iPad he can take anywhere, which seems almost crazy to me that every team in baseball doesn't do that right now. But maybe after seeing Luke Voit, they'll start doing that. So, you know, it really starts with identifying a guy with skill, because, you know, you could have a guy who simply doesn't hit the ball hard or is not going to be talented enough to be a major league player. There's not much you can do for him. So it starts with identifying a guy like Luke Voit who didn't get the opportunity. And then it seems like Voit is the kind of guy who's interested in learning more about how to maximize his skills, and he's with the right organization to do that. That's still the gap I think we see in baseball, that some teams are really good at helping guys get better and some teams not so much. And that gap is closing a little bit. You know, you don't have teams that are 10 miles behind like there used to be. But even the, like, Ron Gardenhire, who is managing the Tigers, this spring said, you know, we're catching up. We're kind of far behind. And the gap is closing, but it's still there. So that's why you see the Yankees, the Astros, the Dodgers, the Rays, et cetera, kind of still out in front on this stuff.
Now, you mentioned that the metrics or the numbers from minor leagues like Voit's are not available to you or to some other people. How is that information distributed on the minor league system? Is that private for each organization and they don't distribute it? Or like, how are the Yankees acquiring numbers on Luke Voit like that? Or is that available to the teams?
Well, it's not one overall system like we have at the major league level. Right. Each team owns and operates their own systems at their own parks. So you can either, get guys who are coming through on the road if you want to get opposing teams. So let's say Luke Voit maybe had played at a Yankee farm system team at some point. Mm-hmm. Or I imagine some teams have, data sharing partnerships where they'll be like, okay, we'll give you our guys when you come through, you give us your guys, et cetera. So that's kind of how it's done. There's not one formal way.
Yeah, I mean, that's super interesting, though, because, the investment. I mean, I know the Orioles were talking about making that investment in personnel and analytics and all these things in the offseason. That was one of the things they were hanging their hat on. But it really does go deep into the system, because if you have that advanced analytics, tracking ability at your own park, well, you have a leg up then on a lot of the competition as far as scouting and seeing what these guys are doing, especially if you're, if you're putting that much money and belief into what the numbers are telling you from guys on a low level. So that's something I never even really thought of. I don't think many people have thought of just that leg up from teams like the Yankees who have put that money into, some of the minor league advanced metric systems. So that's interesting. When you're looking at, and obviously the Yankees are using it because they've gone out there and found some prize pieces. Again, Didi, Hicks, Voit, Herman, Talkman, even like the lower guys, like you're looking at a guy like Talkman, it was kind of, you're looking around and saying, well, why is this guy up here now? Why are we not giving, an opportunity to someone else in the minor leagues? Why are we making this acquisition and then bringing him directly up? And then Urshela is now hitting, he's got 144 OPS plus. Like, can you explain what this guy is doing and how he's doing it?
I mean, for him, I honestly think it is, a lot of small sample. He has always been known as a guy who has a fantastic glove, and I think you've seen that even just his short time in the Bronx. But, nothing about what he's doing is sustainable on an offensive point of view. He's only been in, 20 games and 50 or 60 plate appearances. It's nice that he's gotten off to this good start. It's obviously been a big thing, but I don't think there's really any clearly noticeable change here where you're like, wow, that guy is suddenly different in a way he's never been. And it's probably unlikely he's going to get the chance to continue it. When Andujar comes back, when some of the guys start getting healthy, when LeMahieu's playing a little more third base, he is, a guy with a .388 batting average on balls in play. So a great hot start at the right time, but probably nothing that's, a big change or sustainable for him going forward.
Yeah, if you want some comedy, just go check out some of the Yankees' Twitter and see how people want Urshela instead of Miguel Andujar playing third base, because you get wrapped up in the small sample size and the guys are winning and it's fun and lots of Yankees' Twitter.
I will say this. I do want that on defense.
Yeah, that's true.
And Duar is a lousy fielder, and Urshela is actually pretty good. But at the plate, there's clearly no comparison.
Right. And there's been, there's been lots of talk of Andujar getting better and excel and, improving that defense, obviously. And I think just the opportunity to give him, for him to be on the field so that we can see if he has improved, because obviously that's a big part of, why people wanted to go the other route when they're talking about like Manny Machado or just putting someone else over there. The majority of that conversation started with his defense. So,
yeah. And he's not going to ever be a gold glover, but he's young and it's possible he could improve to, competent as opposed to future DH, which is what it sort of looked like last season.
Yeah. And that's really all he needs. He needs to be, league average or even just a little below league average. It just can't be the horrible, not able to turn a double play. We need a guy that's at least a little bit more average. Something about these Yankees, the replacements that we're calling them, replaced for 28. These guys are on, they're on pace right now. They're currently ranked first in Major League Baseball for team average exit velocity. How is that even possible when they're missing the guys like Judge, Stanton, Sanchez for a long time? I don't get how these guys are doing that at such a high level and the talent's just not there.
Well, I do think any discussion of the recent hot streak with replacement players has to begin a little bit with who they've played. They really have played some of the weakest teams in baseball. Like the Royals aren't any good. The Angels aren't any good. The Giants are terrible. Not to take away from what the Yankees have done, but it's been fortunate timing, because remember right before that, they got swept by the Astros. And yes. I still believe in the Yankees, but you do have to at least keep track of, wow, they've played some pretty rotten teams. As far as the hard hit rate goes, You know, part of that is, you know, Aaron Judge was hitting the ball hard before he got hurt. You know, it's not like this only just started when everybody got hurt. But you do have some guys who are hitting the ball harder than ever. Obviously, like Gary Sanchez coming back in his limited playing time and being a beast is great. And I think, you know, Luke Voit, obviously, but I think people don't think enough about what a, you know, above-average offensive player DJ LeMahieu is. Like, I wrote about this over the winter. People assumed he'd leave Colorado and, you know, he'd go back to his, whatever, 270 career road on base percentage. And that's not really how it works. That's never how it works when somebody leaves the Rockies. But he's kind of exceeded expectations. I mean, he's got a 50% hard hit rate, which is, you know, phenomenal for a guy you kind of think of as a somewhat light-hitting middle infielder. And obviously his glove is great. Because if you look up and down the lineup, you know, the only guys who are sort of below average in hard hit would be Brett Gardner, who you don't really expect that from, Urshela, and then in, you know, small samples, Tyler Wade and Tulowitzki, you know, and you didn't expect much from Tyler Wade anyway. So the fact is these guys are hitting the ball, you know, not insanely hard, but hard enough up and down the lineup. There hasn't really been one black hole as far as power goes other than, you know, Gardner. And again, that's not really his game.
And Judge, before he went down, and maybe this is just a small sample sizing, but his percentage, I'm sorry, his slugging percentage before his injury is lower than, you know, his hard hits. It's lower than normal. So do you see any like corresponding reason why the hard hit balls are not, you know, corresponding to that standard of high slugging percentage? Is it, you know, I know he's had a new two strike approach, or potentially the conspiracy theorists out there, which I might be one of them, thinks that he has been injured for a little bit longer than we all expect.
Well, I'm not going to get into the conspiracy theory because I have no knowledge of any of that. I think part of it was that probably his 2017 was so insanely good that it's an unreasonable expectation.
Yeah.
For anyone to stick to, like, I'm looking at it now. His season to date before he got hurt, it looks in the slash line, it looks pretty close to what it was last year. And I know last year seemed like a disappointment because it wasn't the year before, but it was still pretty good. It looks like he's hitting the ball, you know, a little higher than he was last year, which is good. But yeah, I just don't know that anybody was going to repeat that 2017. That was the kind of year where everything went absolutely perfectly, you know, and he was really off to a fantastic start this year. The strikeouts were down slightly. The hard hit rate is up. I'm not going to worry too much about the outcome numbers in his, you know, 20 games or whatever it was. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that's troubling because it's not the first time he's been hurt with this injury. And he's obviously a very large man, and he's going to be out for, I'm not even sure we know a return date. And then you kind of wonder how this is affecting when he comes back.
Yeah, that's the thing with an oblique injury, I think, with a guy like you said. So how big he is, it's going to take even longer for a guy like that to get back and then get his timing right. And, you know, I got to believe when you're that big, the timing, if it's thrown off a little bit, it's a lot harder to get all in sync. I mean, that's a lot of Aaron Judge to get in sync, you know, and coming back from an injury in the middle of a season. So he's done it in the past, but yeah, like we don't know what his time frame is. And I think that time frame is probably going to be longer, even if it was a small injury. I mean, I still think that they were going to make sure things calmed down and then get him back into the flow of things at his own pace. Certainly not going to rush him. Looking at the other side of the coin, I want to talk about Domingo Germán a little bit because he's obviously come around and been a really big part of this rotation, especially with Severino going down and really not being able to step up in that number one spot that we all expected him to do. But Herman's really been putting up the, you know, similar numbers and kind of taken that pressure off of the rotation. Do you see what are you looking at when you see Germán? Because I know they identified him during that trade. That was the original trade from the Marlins was for Eovaldi and Garrett Jones, and basically Germán was a throw-in so that Garrett Jones' contract could be included in there. But I have seen that the Yankees identified him early with the Marlins as a top prospect. They think that he was going to be a guy that could progress into something. So, what are you seeing on the metric side of Germán and why he's been so successful?
Well, I think if you look at it, he's actually, his strikeouts are down a little bit from last year, but it looks like his home runs are down by like, you know, two-thirds from last season, which is huge. And it's kind of an outlier in this season where everybody on earth seems to be hitting home runs and allowing home runs. He has done a good job of limiting those home runs, which is a pretty big deal for him. I mean, that's what was killing him before. He's got an interesting fastball. It's like 93rd percentile of spin rate, which is cool. That doesn't guarantee, obviously, any success, but it certainly you know, tends to lend itself to swinging strikes and pop-ups. And he's using his curveball a little more. So, you know, he's always been this interesting guy. He's never really been able to show any consistency The stuff has always been there, as you said, and he's never really had this opportunity. I remember one of his first starts last year. I watched him, and I thought, wow, this guy is going to be incredible. And then, you know, it didn't really come together in that way. But what really stood out to me this year is what happens when he gets into, you know, the spots with men on in tight situations. Last year, he got hit pretty hard. Mm-hmm. This year, if you go look at his stats in, you know, with men on in high leverage situations, he's been incredible. And that's going to keep runs off the board. I don't know that that's a change in skill. I don't know that that's sustainable, but it certainly explains a lot about how that ERA has stayed so low. And he's, you know, I think kind of a good example of, for a lot of teams, he's maybe like the third starter. And for the Yankees, he's maybe the seventh starter. Yeah. And that goes right back to depth. I mean, he's the kind of guy you want. You don't necessarily want to have to rely on to start the year, but you want to have this guy to be able to pull in when you need him. And the Yankees clearly have. So his progression is probably one of the more fascinating things about the season. Like, yeah, James Paxton has been great, no doubt, but whenever healthy, you expect James Paxton to be great. Like, it's not shocking to me that he's been this good. You know, Tanaka is more or less what Tanaka is. J-Hap is what he is, Sabathia, et cetera. But the one guy who's really kind of taken this step forward and shown you something different is Herman. He's, you know, only 26 years old. I'm not sure I still see him as, like, the best pitcher on this staff all season long, but so far he's been huge for them.
Well, what do you think his ceiling is? Because the one thing we did see last year, and you hit it on the head, when he started getting into some of those high-pressure situations, he'd leave the ball over the plate and was getting hit hard. And, you know, you still see all the swing and miss percentage that was some of the, I think it was top 20 in the league, you know, when he was out there. But then you see him getting into trouble, you know, second and third time through the lineup. And you know, his numbers don't look like you want them to towards the end. But the flashes were there. And it seems like this year, whether it's, you know, putting it all together or just more part of the maturation process. But where do you see his ceiling?
I mean, it's always tough to tell. Like, he's got the raw tools, right? But lots of guys have the raw tools and they don't necessarily put them all together. I mean, it certainly seems like the Yankees... let me take a step back on that. The Yankees seem like a great spot for a guy like this because they've got this huge staff and, you know, analytical guys who can really help you get the most out of it. But, you know, we've all seen, you know, that hasn't worked for everybody. It certainly did not work for Sonny Gray, you know, and then he goes off to Cincinnati and he's been really good so far this year. So it's never a one size fits all thing on anything. You know, it's always about getting the right fit between player and city and organization and pitching coach and all of this. And that's why, you know, sometimes fans will kill. I'll give you a good example, right? The Chris Archer trade right now looks terrible for Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. right? Because Archer is like, he's been good, right? But Glasnow looks great and Meadows looks great. And I think what fans kind of miss is that as good as Tyler Glasnow has been for the Rays, and as bad as that looked for the Pirates to give him up, I'm not sure he could have been this guy with the Pirates.
Sure.
You know, it really sounds like he needed, you know, a different pitching strategy or different voices in his ear, whatever the case may be. And going back to Herman, you know, it seems like the Yankees are a good spot for a guy like this. But you never know. You know, so far, so good, because he's got those raw tools. Kind of going back to what I said before, it's not about finding talented guys anymore. Every team can do that. It's about getting the most out of that talent.
Look, the number 55 was great with the Yankees when we had Godzilla and Matsui running it. And then all of a sudden, Sonny Gray comes into town with all this hype and expectations and ruins the number in 55. And we're looking at that. Now we all have a negative impact about that number. And then Domingo Herman comes back in the very next year, plugs into that spot, and the resurgence of number 55 again. So we can all appreciate Domingo Herman very much for that. The AL East, you talked about Tampa being on top of the analytics and looking into the minor league systems and things like that. Is Tampa's pace for real? Are they a team that you think is going to be there at the end?
Oh, they're definitely for real. I was just looking at this morning. If you look at the, like on Fangraphs, you can go and find a leaderboard that shows the last 365 days. So the last calendar year. And over the last calendar year, the Rays have 97 wins, which is the, I think, fifth most in baseball. I don't think that they're necessarily better than the Yankees or the Red Sox over the course of the season. But if you were the Rays and you could plan out the season and think to yourself, okay, what's like the best possible first month? It would be for them to get off to a great start. Every Yankee who ever lived to get hurt, and half of the Red Sox forget how to play baseball, you know, and those things are not going to maintain. You've already seen the Red Sox have played a lot better over the last couple of days. Obviously the Yankees are winning and they're going to get healthier. So it does sort of look like it's going to be, I think, a three-team fight to the end. It would not surprise me in the least if two of these three teams are in the wild card game, whichever combination you prefer. I don't think we've ever seen a Yankee-Red Sox one-game playoff before. That would be pretty fun. And well, that's not true. Obviously, we have with back in the day, but I mean in terms of a wild card.
Right.
Yeah, the Rays are for real. Their pitching is incredible. They have had this streak of moves that have really paid off. Like I said, the Glasnow Meadows trade looks incredible. The Tommy Pham deal looks incredible. Going after Yandy Diaz has really worked out well for them. Picking up G-Man Choi for basically nothing has worked out well for them. They are probably like the most fun team for me to watch right now. When I sit down and I have the choice of all 30 teams to watch, the Rays are generally where I go to just because they're so interesting with these guys that most people don't know, like Diego Castillo and Jose Alvarado and all these relievers. They're for real. I'm not sitting here saying they're going to hold off the Yankees all season long because I picked the Yankees to win the division, and I still think that's probably true. But if I had to pick right now, I'm thinking we're going to see a Red Sox-Rays wildcard game, and that is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, they've done a phenomenal job down there. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It's a shame that they have to play in the trap, and when you're watching those games, you have to see the trap, which looks absolutely terrible on television. So it's not fun to watch them play in that game. But you're talking about Boston and them playing better recently. I mean, do you think that they're going to come back from this? That they have obviously a ton of talent on that team, but do you think they're in serious trouble?
Well, I think that they've got a lot to worry about, but I also think when you look at the American League right now, there's not a ton of competition for the wild card spots. I mean, if you figure that the Astros are clearly going to win the West, and I don't believe in the Mariners at all, so I'm assuming that they're going to fall off. You know, who else is in the mix for the wild card? Three of the teams in the Central aren't going anywhere. I don't believe in Toronto or certainly Baltimore. So the main competition is whichever team doesn't win the Central between the Twins and Cleveland and the other two teams in the East. So I think they're going to make that playoff spot. And really, once you get in there, there's nothing stopping them from making another run. Like, this is still mostly the same team that was so good last year. There's nothing preventing them from making moves to, you know, improve that bullpen or whatever else they need. They're still a very dangerous team that just won the World Series like 6 months ago.
Well, that's the thing. We're talking about the moves that they could potentially make to make their team better, and the bullpen especially. But they didn't make really many moves in the offseason. They signed Eovaldi, didn't really address that bullpen. And you're kind of looking at their situation with the tax threshold too, and wondering if they are going to make that another move to put them over the hump, or last year was cool because we won the World Series and we're going to kind of rest on that for a bit and not go over that, get into more tax implications because of that. So I'm interested to see how it's going to play out. The Yankees are in a similar situation in the sense that they're close to the second threshold, and what's that going to look like at the trade deadline? Is there a move to be made that will put them over, and are they willing to make that move?
Yeah, I think there is. They certainly have never shown the inclination to be passive. They're going to go out and find the right move for them, and I think there's going to be some interesting guys in the market, especially if some of the other American League teams fall out of the mix. Wouldn't surprise me to see the Reds start being sellers at some point, and they have some interesting relievers. So these three teams, I think all three of them in the East, are going to make a lot of noise this summer at the trade deadline.
At what point do you start looking at trends and in a season and saying that these are things that we can really look on and rely upon? Like, is there a point when you're like, okay, there's been enough games and we can start looking at these trends as absolutely like very real things?
Well, it sort of depends on which trend. League-wide trends, I think you can already put a lot of stock into the fact that home runs are up and are probably going to break records, and strikeouts are up, shifts are up. That stuff is all, pretty reliable at this point. Individual guys, it really depends on the player and the amount of time and the stat before you get too deep into most of that. Like, I think Cody Bellinger is going to have a great season. I don't think he's going to continue hitting like peak Babe Ruth for the next 6 months. But as far as league-wide trends go, yeah, you can put a lot of stock into what you're seeing across the game right now. More velocity, fewer fastballs, more home runs, all that.
So the Yankees are going home to face Minnesota, and they've hit the ball hard. But I saw you tweeting about this as well, potentially mostly about the Baltimore pitching and less about the Twins offense. But what are we to expect from this Twins offensive team?
Well, they're weird, right? Because the Twins have gotten off to like the best slugging start in franchise history. But that says a little bit about the way baseball is played in 2019. And it says a lot about how many times they face the Orioles. The Orioles are probably, I don't know, this sounds like hyperbole, and maybe it is, but they may be the worst pitching staff in the history of baseball.
Yeah.
So they certainly fattened up on those teams, on those guys, and then they were more or less league average against other teams. So I still look at them as an above-average offense. I think Jorge Polanco is having the quietest breakout in baseball right now. I think Nelson Cruz is continuing the slug. I don't think that they are going to be the best slugging team in the game as they have been right now. because they're just not going to face the Orioles, and some of these guys are going to come back to earth. But, you know, they're for real. I'm very out on Cleveland, and I think the Twins didn't really do enough this winter to make that push, but they still can. You know, they can be the team that gets Kimbrel or Keuchel or makes a trade, because the window is wide open, and there's really no point for them waiting. They're a tough team right now.
And so just to kind of respond to that as well, the Cleveland, you mentioned that you're very out on them. What's the – did they miss opportunities to sell off more pieces than they should have? Or because obviously they kept the pitching staff relatively intact, and they're able to compete in that way. But what's the reason why you're out on them so hard?
Well, no, not sell off. The opposite. They didn't do anything to add this winter.
Right.
Their offense is – the offense is terrible, the outfield especially. You know, it was unexpected that – Lindor got hurt, to be sure. But Ramirez really was not very good the last 2 months of last season. Yeah. And he's still somewhat of a question mark for me. Lindor only just came back, and the rest of the offense is weak. Now, the rotation is fantastic, but even that's a little weak because Mike Clevinger got hurt, and Corey Kluber is off to a bit of a tough start. And I think that they just didn't do anything this winter to try to improve. And I think they've been able to coast on that very weak division for a couple of years. And the Twins are going to try to change that this year. I mean, this is their time. This is the time to topple Cleveland. There is no point in waiting another year.
Well, let's hope the Twins don't pick that up or hear you talking about that when they come into the Yankee Stadium. Obviously, the Yankees and the Twins, the Yankees have always had a very, very good experience with the Twins when they play them. So hopefully that will continue on our end at least. But, Mike, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate your insight and diving into some more of these numbers so we can see, you know, why things are actually happening.
Great.
Hey, guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.